Anyway, we're going to talk about faith and medicine, and this is the outline for what we're going to discuss today. I'm going to introduce this. I have a few disclaimers, some definitions about the term, so we're talking about the same thing when we talk about faith or we talk about religion, we talk about spirituality, we sort of have a sense that we're talking about the same thing. We're going to talk about religiosity, spirituality, and health status. We're going to look at that from an individual point of view. We're going to look at it from a national point of view. Or international point of view, and then we'll talk and explore intercessory prayer, and we'll have some discussion and conclusions. I don't know if we can be able to conclude very much, but we can certainly have some discussions. We have time. What I'm trying to do with this is to look at this from a relatively secular point of view, but look at what kind of data are out there. That support one view or another, that what kind of scientific evidence is out there and what kind of data with respect to epidemiologic studies and outcome studies. So disclosures, disclaimers, and apologies. I am not, as you all know, I am not a man of the cloth. I'm not a philosopher. I've been a practicing physician for 40-some years. And so I am not an expert on any of this, but I've had a lot of time to learn from my patients, deal with my patients, talk to them from all walks of life, and I've learned a lot from them over the time. I apologize in advance if I say anything that offends anyone. I bet I do. So I apologize before we even start. So nothing is intended to stick a finger in somebody's eye or anything else. What I'm trying to do is to present what's out there. So from an educational point of view, I think it's important that you know what is out there and what other people are saying and what kind of information is out there so that we have a tendency to talk to ourselves or preach to the choir or look in the mirror and talk and say things. And so I hope this opens some perspectives for all of us. Okay, that's me, specializing in disease of the insurer, which is what most physicians in the United States have done. Faith and medicine is the topic, and just as we've spent some time in the Bible study about how we interpret a word, whether the word means something or whether it could be interpreted or viewed in different ways, faith and medicine mean something. Well, we deal with faith and medicine, they're in a relationship. We took faith as medicine. Does faith actually cure? Or do we have faith in medicine? And obviously those little words mean a whole lot. We're talking about very different things. So we're going to really be talking about faith and medicine. And we really need to talk more than just faith and medicine, but rather faith, spirituality, religion, and health. And how those factors, faith, spirituality, religion, influence health, both on a personal basis, individual basis, and societal basis. Okay, some definitions. And anybody wants to object to these definitions, that's fine, but we kind of need to talk about, we need to be on the same page. So these definitions are taken from dictionaries. I just didn't make them up. Faith is a confident belief that does not rest on logical proof or material evidence. So that's different from a conclusion that's drawn from a scientific study. So that something that one accepts and accepts as being true without needing. So not only doesn't have to have it, it doesn't even need it in order to have that belief. And a second definition is belief and trust in God. So that's what we're really talking about when we refer to faith. Now, religion is different from faith, as you all know. And again, I am not, you people can all explain this probably a lot better than I, but the term religion derives from the Latin religare, and which means to bind together. And it does, and religions do bind people together in an organized system of beliefs and practices. So that's a little different from faith per se. Religiosity is the degree of participation in beliefs and practices of an organized religion. I already brought up Catholic, and in the we have all these cafeteria Catholics, you know, that only believe certain things in the Catholic faith and don't, it's all over the place. They consider themselves good Catholics. They go to church, maybe not every week, but frequently. And some believe in abortion, some don't. Some believe in birth control. Most believe in birth control, but a few don't. So one can belong to religion, but religiosity is the degree of participation within that set of. And that's one of the things we can kind of get a handle on when we're going to kind of look at people and say, you know, are you likely to be more healthy if you're religious? Well, it's kind of hard to say if you're religious, but we can say if you have a high degree of religiosity, you go to church every holy day of obligation, you go to church every Sunday, you participate in the religious activities of that organized religion. Spirituality is much harder to get your hands around. We had a little discussion about that this morning in the at the Bible study. It derives from the Greek's word for breath. It's almost the essence of one's life, and it's the quality of holding a philosophy, doctrine, or religion, emphasizing the vital spirit rather than the material. So it's something that goes beyond, these rocks right here. It transcends that in some way. And it really is hard to get your hands around what spirituality is and how to identify someone who is spiritual, someone who isn't spiritual. And I might very well feel that I'm very spiritual, and someone that knows me reasonably well may feel that I'm not spiritual at all. And the same thing also applies to other people. So it's a really dynamic concept that's hard to get your hands around. It has something to do with in looking for meaning in life. Transcendence is something more than existence, and involves values. And I'll just use an example for me. I have this thing about trees. I have personally planted about 20,000 trees on my property where we're developing a wildlife refuge. And planted so many that I got carpal tunnel and had to have surgery on my hand. But when I see a big tree, an old growth tree, it's almost a stretch. It's almost a religious experience. It goes beyond me. I feel a connection to that tree that goes far beyond my life. That tree started hundreds of years ago, maybe thousands of years ago, and it's going to be around long after I go. And there's a transcendence. There's something to me that's spiritual. Someone else may say, you know, that's just weird, but that's what I. That's from just a personal point of view. So, but spirituality obviously means different things to different people, and it's very hard to get your hands on spiritual. You know, is it church? Is it a beautiful sunset in Africa? Flowers? Is it music? Is it poetry? It's.
Can I say something?
It's all those things.
I just came.
I know you missed all the first important part of it.
I was gluing. I couldn't stop. I was in the middle of gluing. Anybody see the movie Avatar? About the tree, the tree was their god was the tree. So I wanted to bring that up.
Okay, well
that's all.
They must have got the idea from me. So when trying to get a handle on religiosity, spirituality, and health status, we can't measure in the scientific world, and you just can't measure spirituality. We can measure religiosity. Historically, to go back to religion or religiosity, just to kind of look at it, this is not me saying that doctors are doctors or priests or something, but in many cultures, a priest and physician is one and the same, and has been historically one and the same. And basically, we're trying to answer the individual's existential questions. What's happening to you? Somebody gets really sick, they develop a big tumor, they're bleeding, something bad is happening to them. They want to know what's going on. They want to know what's going to happen and what can be done to improve the status. And that question was asked to the priest, the medicine man, the shaman. And now these questions are asked to a large extent to the physicians for individual patients. So if you drive into Corvallis, Oregon, from the north, you'll see up on the hill, biggest building in town is the medical center. You drive into almost any city now, it's the medical center. We drove by Swedish Hospital in Seattle, a big, huge medical center. It's the town's dominant architecture. It used to be that it was the, either the temple or the cathedral was the dominant architecture. Now it's the medical, priests and physicians, kind of one and the same in some ways. The sanctuary of the temple is now the operating room. Only certain people can go into it. Used to be robes, now it's the surgical gowns. They used to make sacrifices. They would open up an animal and predict what was going to happen. Now we open up a patient and predict what's going to happen. The similarities are just too great to say, well, this just kind of happened. You know, this is just, I mean, it's almost bizarre when you think about it. So the role of the priest in the temple was to explain, predict, and influence the course of events. And now, for an individual who's concerned about his health or what's going on, the physician diagnoses and explains. He prognosticates, he comes up with a prognosis, predicts what's going to happen, and then tries to treat it to change the outcome. The similarities are just absolutely amazing. All right, so let's see about what we can document in terms of beneficial effects of religiosity. And as I said, we can't quantify or really get our handle on and measure spirituality. If anybody thinks they, I would like to know how they would think they could measure that. But we can measure religiosity. And there's been a large number of studies done over the years that associate the degree of religious activities, that's religious religiosity, and the studies are usually based upon how many times you go to church a week or a month or something like that gets a handle on that. Compare it to people who don't go to church very much at all and see who's healthy. And so they're observational or epidemiologic studies and prospective. There are no control studies. It's hard to have a control study and try to get a group of people to say, now you guys all go to church and you guys don't go to church and you guys believe it, you don't, and see who does better. That's really really not capable. We're not capable of doing that. And finally, I just want to touch on the role of religiosity in the physician. Does that play a role? So if you have if you go to your doctor, we heard last night about one of our people here. I don't know if she's here now, but you know, her first physician wasn't listening to her. Second physician did. He was a Muslim. It was kind of an interesting. I don't know what the beliefs of the first physician were. And would you choose a physician on the basis of religion if you had that choice, or if you knew? Would you only go to a Christian, or would you only go to a Muslim, or would you only go to a secular physician? All right. Beneficial.
Can I just offer
yes, sir.
A competing viewpoint for 1 second?
Sure.
There's a bias in what you just put there, and the bias is that what matters is what can be measured. And you can measure, I believe, spirituality, but it's not in a quantitative sense, in a qualitative sense. And there has been research done within a qualitative framework.
I don't question that at all.
Okay.
I guess what I'm saying is hard. In fact, it's right up there. You can't quantify it or measure it in that way. I mean, you can sort of
right.
You sort of get a feel for it, an understanding for it. And you can, you know, I mean, it's sort of like what the Supreme Court said about pornography. You know, we can't define it, but we can recognize it.
And I think what's happened within the academy is that there is a bias that what matters is what's quantifiable, and what doesn't matter is what's qualitative. I'm just bringing that up as another viewpoint.
I agree completely. All right, the beneficial effects of religious behavior, are there any? And there are a lot. Mortality data. Many studies, 18 prospective studies, 17 out of the 18 demonstrated that those individuals who go to church on a regular basis have better health outcomes than those that don't go to church at all or only go rarely. One study, it was actually done with veterans, it didn't turn out that way for whatever reason. But a 28-year study involving more than 5,000 adults between the age of 21 and 65, those that attended religious services once a week or more had a 23% reduction in their death rate than those who never went to church. A 5-year study looking at just under 2,000 adults who were over the age of 55 showed a 24% reduction in mortality. And a 6-year study, and these are just examples of, as I said, there are 17 of 18, looking at 4,000 adults greater than the age of 65, there was a 28% reduction in deaths amongst those who were regular attendees of church. So when it just comes to overall mortality, it appears that if you go to church on a regular basis, you're going to have better health outcomes with respect to mortality. Cardiovascular disease, a number of studies were done in Israel. They're looking at comparing secular Jewish men and women compared to Orthodox Jewish men and women. And the secular group had, the men had a 4 times increased risk of a heart attack. The women had a 7 times increased risk of a heart attack. Now in Israel, roughly 35% to 40% of the population are non-believers. We don't really think about that, but that is a very, it's not an insignificant percentage of individuals. A larger study looking at 10,000 Israeli civil servants, the Orthodox compared to the secular, 20% reduction in coronary heart disease. Not all studies showed that, but 12 of the 16 published studies when it lasted a literature search here showed that. High blood pressure. 14 of 16 studies showed that blood pressure tends to be lower in people who go to church more frequently. Study 4,000 adults over the age of 65 demonstrated that decreased blood pressures. When dealing with end-of-life issues, acceptance at end-of-life, although we heard somebody make a statement last night about sometimes there are individuals who just sort of hang on and who are very religious and want to hang on, there seems to be a less death anxiety. And that seems to be irrelevant of whether or not they believe in life after death. But if they have been religious and attend religious services on a regular basis, they tend to accept death and have less death anxiety. Mental health, pretty much the same thing, and I won't belabor the thing too much, but depression, majority of studies have demonstrated decreased less depression in people who go to church on a regular basis. Anxiety, less anxiety in those in the age, a big study, 3,000 adults, looked at less anxiety in the 18 to 39-year-old group, but no difference in the 60 to 79-year-old. So going to church when you're older didn't seem to have a whole lot of influence on anxiety. Substance abuse, there's less substance abuse associated with religiosity. And suicide, it's an inverse relationship between the belief of in God and religious practices with the frequency or incidence of suicide. So you go right down the list, the data are pretty good. There's a pretty strong association. What about if your doctor's religious? As far as I know, there are no studies that have looked at that to see whether outcomes are better. I think the medical profession's afraid of this one. However it turned out, there's going to be some unhappy people. Probably could be done. You could certainly find out, the physicians that go to church on a regular basis versus believers versus physicians who are not, and see whether their patients do better. That would be I'd almost like to do this. So are you better off with a religious doctor?
That's a question.
I don't know.
I don't know if you're going to go into this or not, but I just had a question about the studies that you're talking about and the spectrum of people that have been surveyed, because it seems like at least the churches that I've visited, the people who are attending the church are generally the middle class white who are kind of better off, healthier as it is to begin with. And so I was just wondering if there's
You are right on. you are right on. So is it a causation or is it just an association? And that's really the question you're asking. It correlates with the health outcomes. But what's the story? So okay, now religious people.
Can I say one thing too that was interesting is the ELCA right now is doing a big health initiative over the last few years among their leaders, clergy and such, because they have high anxiety, high hypertension, high emotional disorders and things like that. Extreme, overweight, don't exercise,
so
don't have problems.
Their flock is doing well, but
they're
suffering because of it. Okay,
I just want to point that out. It was kind of funny I was saying this would not be true amongst the leaders.
That may very well be a good point. I've not been aware of any data about that, but that's interesting. Okay, so if you look at people who go to church on a regular basis and then look at their health habits and what makes them different from people who don't go to church, they tend to exercise more. They eat a little bit better. Look at the way people eat here at Holden Village, as an example. Much more seatbelt use. That's really interesting, isn't it? They are less likely to smoke, less substance abuse, greater use of preventative services. They're more likely to follow their physician's advice. If somebody said you have to go to church every Sunday, and they do, they tend to be more obedient type of person. And then if the physician says stop smoking, you know, take these pills, I mean, it's as from a practicing medical point of view, it's very hard to get people to do what you want them to do. You know, they just do what they, you know, I mean, you can educate them, you can tell them, you can write the prescription, you know, something like 30% of prescriptions never get filled. And the majority of prescriptions are never taken all the way through. I suspect, how many people have pills in their medicine cabinets at home that they didn't complete, you know, that they were prescribed and they didn't complete? Yeah, it's usually people, you know, it's the majority of people. Now, religious folks are going to be much less likely to do this, you know, to have those, because you guys, there weren't a whole lot of you that did that.
Well, we go through and take it once in a while.
Yeah, treat yourself, that's a good idea. Okay, so what are some of these beneficial mediators of the religiosity? Healthy habits, obedience, we talked about obedience. Mm-hmm.
Social support. Yeah.
You join the Lions Club or the Audubon Society, is this going to be as good as going to church? I don't know. Positive emotions, we talked yesterday, the Nun Study. Positive emotions are certainly a lot of what you get in a religious service is encouragement and positive. Relaxation, there's probably no better way to induce what's called the relaxation response. This has been studied at Harvard by Herbert Benson. By a chant, you can lower your blood pressure, lower your pulse rate. Prayer does the exact same thing.
Singing hymns.
All
I thought
things.
You were going to say sermons.
Sermons put you to sleep, so I guess that's like taking your nap. They already said the naps were good, so.
I heard that, Jackie, when you were in church.
Sleeping in church is a good thing. That's a nice, quiet place, isn't it? Reduce stress response, enhance immune response, and we get the placebo effect, if you believe it's going to help you. Okay, so despite all the evidence suggesting that religious activity is associated with better health, religious people still get sick, they still die, they're still human. And from a population perspective, it may not be quite as clear in terms of the relationship, and we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. So, conclusions of the beneficial effects of religious activity and religion. There's evidence to support that religious activities promote health. The evidence is weak, and the studies have these epidemiologic flaws for the points that you made, David, that we're really comparing apples and oranges. Church attendance data is self-reported. You know, people don't always tell you the truth about the church. Many, if not most, patients believe that religious activity and prayer promotes health. So they already believe that, and so that may have a confounding influence. And whether or not religion helps, it's possible to adapt or adopt all of those health behaviors that are associated with religion yourself. You don't have to go to church to stop smoking. You don't have to go to church to exercise more and eat properly. To have social interactions and to have periods of relaxation or meditation. Yes, sir.
Well, as I was thinking here, in terms of you talking about church attendance, I have some of these same studies been done in Europe, where they claim they're believers, but very little, it seems. I've been there. I mean, it's very little church attendance. Has that?
You know, almost all these studies have been U.S. studies. There were some, U.S. and Israel seems to have no common of the studies. There seems to be less interest amongst the medical community and the general community in Europe to do the studies. So most of what we have, a few of them are based in Europe, but almost the overwhelming have been U.S. studies. So I can't answer that question. I don't know, but I think it's a good point, and we'll sort of touch on it tangentially at least when we kind of look at some global effects. Okay, so are there other beneficial effects that can impact on health that religion can contribute in a positive way? And we talked about, you know, what determines health. That health care is just one little piece of it, whereas societal factors, environmental factors, genetic factors, all these other things. And religion certainly has done a lot of really good things to promote health. There's just no question about it. Faith-based safety nets, church-based schools, colleges, hospitals. I mean, it's a long tradition in this country and abroad that the churches have supported hospitals and healthcare systems. Missionary work, prison-based missionary work, faith-based support for substance abuse and physical and sexual abuse, and certainly religious thought has contributed very significantly to our understanding of medical ethics and the development of medical ethics. And so all of those things are very, very positive and are positive contributors to the health of individuals. But there's a dark side. And to deny it this is out of our local newspaper. Oregon has, in the past year and a half, sent several people to prison because of what amounts to child abuse, to withholding medical care for entirely treatable conditions in cases where children have died. One child lost eyesight. Tragic, based on faith healing. Faith healing. Now, this, you can say, "Oh, this is not mainstream. This is out of the realm." You know, Lutherans and Catholics would never do this. It's cult and all this other kind of stuff. But it is based in a religious belief systems that can have a very negative impact. And you don't need to know all the other the bad things that can arise out of religion that adversely affect health. Avoids the necessary care we just referred to. People who really struggle with religion, and the comment about the leaders in the churches who are undergoing, trying to pull together varying thoughts and individuals, and trying to develop the unity that we've talked about so much every morning of how you pull that together, and that's stressful for a leader trying to figure out how to do that and not compromising their own values in the process. Conflict with care providers. I think of Gage worked in OBGYN, and a pregnant teenager comes in, and the caregiver doesn't believe that abortion is even an option, doesn't discuss it, doesn't creates a very difficult relationship. War, persecution, terrorism. I'm not in any way implying that that's the only. It's only religion that causes all those things. It's fighting over oil and everything else. Educational influences. I mean, how long will we set back in terms of scientific advances because of dogma? And how long did it take Charles Darwin to publish his because he was afraid? Limits on availability of care. Birth control, we just mentioned, or abortion. Catholic Church should be just absolutely ashamed of itself, what it did in Africa in the 1990s, which was to embark on a public relations campaign, advertising campaign that they spent, I don't know how much money, but it was in terms of several million dollars, to say that condoms did not prevent AIDS, because they did not want the condoms to be used for birth control. And how many Africans have died because of that? So it can have a negative impact as well as the positive and good things. What about international and national implications? So there's a huge. This was mentioned just a second ago about the variability in some European countries, for example, they don't. Not many people go to church. So there's this huge variability of religious beliefs and religiosity across nations. Many nations are overwhelmingly atheistic. And there's two types of atheism, and I think we really have to make a distinction here and not get hung up when we say, oh yeah, well, it's China and Vietnam and North Korea, they're atheists. But that's coercive atheism. The totalitarian states that outlaw religion or suppress religion and don't give people a chance, a choice. So to say that the population of North Korea is really atheistic, I don't know what that means, because somebody wouldn't dare have a church service because they'd be run off someplace. But there is something called organic atheism, which occurs in the open democratic countries. I just listed three that have very high levels of non-believers. And of all the industrialized countries, the United States is by far the most religious, by any criteria of the questions that are asked of the population. So if we just kind of look at rates of non-believers in different countries, it's kind of impressive of what's really going on out there. It may shock. I know a lot of people just look at that and say, God, I can't believe that. But it's true, and the studies, multiple census type data that's been collected. But the United States is way, way down, and in terms of, it's something to the tune of, depending on who you look at, something would be 4 to 10% would consider themselves, and another 5% or 8% would be agnostic. So it's way down there. Canada, this is where Canada is. Does anybody recognize that list compared to the list we were looking at on Monday?
Yep.
We were listing health status in countries. We were looking at infant mortality. We were looking at longevity. We were looking at a whole bunch of health statistics, and my goodness, those are the same countries that have universal health insurance. They have a single payer or some kind of a network for health care, and they have good health statistics. Yeah, so when you look at this, you say highly religious nations really fare pretty poorly when you look at standard measurements of societal health. I'm talking about societal health, not talking about individual. So we say, look at infant mortality, you look at poverty, you look at extremes of wealth and poverty, you look at homicide rates, literacy, gender equality. The most religious countries have some of the worst problems with gender equality. You look at Norway and Sweden in terms of their representation in their houses of parliament, they have more than 50% women. Norway has a law that says that the corporate boards of directors have to have 50% women. Yes, sir.
But would you put that last, I'm having some trouble just with the implication that there's a correlation between believers, non-believers, and the health of a nation. I have no problem believing that something has happened in this country that has caused some very serious and mean tendencies to surface in the country, but I don't think it's let me finish my sentence. That can be put on the backs of religion here. That there's some problems in this country that are independent of faith.
Oh, absolutely, and I don't mean to make that implication. I'm putting up some data here, and I hope I haven't. And if I have, call me on that if I've made the implication that in order to have a good healthcare system, you kind of have to be non-believer. A non-believing country by definition has a better healthcare system. I'm just saying that, there are a lot of right-wing evangelical Christians in this country who feel that if you had a non-believing society, it would just fall apart. They'd be killing it, there'd be blood in the streets, and nobody'd be taking care of each other. I think this is what this demonstrates, that you can have, it doesn't necessarily correlate with that at all.
I just wanted to say
that. Yeah, no,
there's a question.
Yes.
I don't doubt that, I mean, I know there are a lot of non-believers in Scandinavia, but I also think that those three first countries, historically, their society was based on Christianity or Christian values. And I wonder if that has something to do with their good points in their healthcare.
Yeah, you know, those are very powerful values that that Christianity has fostered through the centuries that are reflected in these countries. Yes, but they're also reflected in current Japan. Mm-hmm. And Japan's gone through a very different historical. So you get the different routes.
Sure. Yeah.
You don't have to follow one route or another. You don't have to go through Imperial Japan and do what Japan did in the early part of the 20th century, and you know, now say, look how great we are. So,
but what about then? And this is, I'm just trying to get straight on it, on what we do with, you know, when I think of Japan, you know, I think of one of the more, you know, I'm going to go to the spiritual word, but I think of a country and a nation that's very spiritual. So, you know, and it may be, you know, it may be, I don't know what to do with the language. I get confused by the language that's up there.
I'm confused too, and okay. I think we should be confused, because okay. It isn't clear. It isn't clear what that means and what non-believer means. You know,
yeah, they're
because that may, you know, that may be that they, you know, it's
okay.
it's much more nuanced than by
yeah.
What. Okay. So it may be a very different thing between what is the individual relationship in this versus what is the societal relationship. So.
Okay.
The results, you just can't throw that data away. I mean, there may be all kinds of explanations, and I think it's important that we look at that and try to figure out, you know, why is it that the data show what they show? And there may be lots and lots of different interpretations, and I don't have an interpretation that answers the questions. But basically, you know, we have, like in everything else, there's two sides to the coin, and there have been obviously some very wonderful things and some dark side, and somewhere is a balance in there. Okay. The next part we'll go into some intercessory prayer, but I'd be very happy to listen to any comments or thoughts or and Jim, I appreciate your comments very much.
Historically, how homogeneous are each of the Scandinavian countries, particularly compared to us, as a very diverse?
You know, that's a very important point. That almost every one of these countries that has developed their their social networks and their support systems have been relatively homogeneous. They're facing the same kind of crisis that we are, though. I mean, if you go to France, and now the most rapidly growing minority is a Muslim minority, and there's all kinds of, and there's country. And the same thing in the Netherlands. It's an extremely tense situation there between the various ethnic and religious groups. So, you know, they are beginning to feel some of the migrations. And what I understand about global climate change, there are going to be some huge migrations of populations moving, and that's a very scary thought about how these different cultures and ethnic groups are going to collide.
So that's somewhat true in Norway as well. One of our friends who just a couple of years ago served in the ELCA church in Oslo said that as churches close, they're bought up by Muslim religions. And that is a fast-growing religious group in a country like Norway, which we tend to not be aware of. I was not aware of that. So I think you're saying...
Well, that's a really interesting thought, isn't it? That the Norway, that Muslim, you know, that Islam may be the predominant religion in Norway.
Yeah.
I mean, just what, I mean, I was just kind of blow you away.
Well, they're moving away from state religion,
yeah.
As far as from Lutheranism.
But isn't it still a state?
It's
no?
A state church, but it's changing drastically.
Okay.
Any other comments about these days?
But I see, I believe that in Norway and some of those other countries, one of the reasons they've been so open to immigration and refugees is because of their Christian background and culture. Now, I know that there are a lot of people who don't believe in God anymore, but I still think they've absorbed some of that from their the history of that.
All right, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about intercessory prayer. And again, we need to get some definitions. You all know what prayer is, petition to God or another deity. And there's two ways to look at it. One, you can ask for strength or equanimity in the face of adversity. Or you can ask God to actually intercede on your behalf or behalf of another. And those are two very different things. So intercessory prayer is this entreaty to God or another deity to intervene on behalf of oneself. So you can pray for yourself, please, you know, God, cure me of this cancer. Or you can say, cure my dear friend of cancer. Or you can just pray for someone who doesn't, and your friend knows about that you're praying for them. Or you can pray for someone who doesn't know that you're praying at all for them. A whole bunch of stuff has been done to kind of look at. I look at this one. The American Medical Association surveyed U.S. citizens in 2008, so relatively recent data. And they said if the doctors were treating your family member and said futility had been reached, and, you know, old dad is going to die with nothing we can do, would you believe that divine intervention by God could save your family member? You think? It's more or less than 10% of the population thinks that would happen, or could happen. More? More than 50%. More than 90%. Kind of hard to know, isn't it? Just out of the blue, you know. So this is presumably a cross section based on, they usually use Gallup polling, somebody to kind of get a cross section of Americans. 57% felt that yes, that God could intervene. And could say, didn't say would, but could. They looked at the nurses and physicians, and I don't know the breakdown in terms of whether it was 50-50, 50% nurses, 50% doctors, but looking at health professionals, just about 20%, one in five felt that. That's just kind of interesting. Okay, historical relationship, you know, I mean, relationship between religion and healing, the priest, miracles, all those kinds of things that, you know, when God intervened. Sir Francis Galton was a cousin of Charles Darwin, published a whole bunch of books back in the 1800s. Pretty smart guy, also, he was also tweaking people all the time, too. So he said, he was one of the first epidemiologists, and he said, okay, we're going to figure out if who is being prayed for the most. And the royal family, you know, everybody's praying for God save the queen, for God save the king. So he went back into all the records and compared the longevity of the British royal family with the general population and found that there was no difference. So maybe, but you know, I mean, you know, I don't know whether you're really praying for the king, you know, you may be under your breath saying, you know, God damn the king, you know. Depending on the tax levels or whatever. So he did another thing. This guy, he was really a kind of interesting guy. He said, okay, there's a lot of ships are going back and forth across the Atlantic. Some were carrying slaves back in the 1800s. And some were carrying missionaries. And said, you know, certainly if you look at records of how many ships went down and wrecks and crashed and got blown away in storms, you know, the missionaries ought to do better, right? I mean, there's no question about that. So he went to the records, and so it was hard to get his handle on that, so he went to Lloyd's of London at that, the Lloyd's has been around for a long time, and looked at insurance rates for the ships. Because if anyone was going to know that certain ships were at higher risk of going down than other ships, Lloyd's of London would have figured it out, because the insurance companies figured these things out. And it turns out that the rates were the same. They insured the ships for the same rates, whether they were slave ships or whether they were missionary ships. So he came to the conclusion that praying didn't do much good under those circumstances. Florence Nightingale felt that when people seemed to be unconscious, a word of prayer sometimes really got through to them. So we get to a more modern time, back in the 20th century. A number of studies have been done. This study looking at rheumatic disease patients, they had people pray for those patients. They didn't seem to do very much good. Dr. Bird at University of California, San Francisco, the San Francisco General Hospital Critical Care Unit, he got born-again Christians to pray for a group of people in the intensive care unit. One group didn't pray for the others, and it turned out that there was a slight difference. Those that were prayed for required less antibiotics and less diuretics and were on fewer days on life support, but there was no difference in the overall mortality.
Did the patients know if they were being treated?
These patients did not know. Yeah, that's an important question. These patients did not know. Mayo Clinic did a big study of 800 patients in the critical care unit. The people who did the praying knew the patient's first name. They knew the diagnosis and a few things about them. In this group, the patients knew they might be being prayed. Didn't know for sure, because half of them got prayed for and the other half didn't. Seemed to make no difference in the outcome. So even as recently as 1999, people trying to get a handle on this and trying to, you know, in the scientific literature, it's published in the Proceedings of the Mayo Clinic, a study out of Israel published in the British Medical Journal, perhaps the most prestigious of the British medical journals, Lancet is the other one, over 3,000 patients undergoing cardiac procedures. The prayer group seemed to do, and again, they knew they might be prayed for. They didn't know for sure they'd be prayed for. There was a little difference in the hospital stays, a little less fever, but no difference in how many people survived. The big study that was going to solve the problem, John Templeton Foundation, which you may be familiar with, one of the world's richest men was, Sir John Templeton came up with multi-million dollars to fund this. Herbert Benson is kind of the father of the mind-body connection, a lot of stuff. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School. This was done in 2005. 1,800 patients undergoing coronary artery bypass surgery. Six U.S. hospitals, three groups. So 1,800 patients, roughly 600 people in each group. One group were told they might be prayed for, and they got prayed for. And the prayers went on. They had a group of people to pray, and they prayed for 14 days, starting the day before surgery and for the next 13 days. One group were told they might get prayed for and didn't, and nobody prayed for them. And then there was one group that told that they were going to get prayed for, and they did get prayed for. For those scientifically minded people, we're missing a group here, and a group that were told that they would get prayed for but didn't get prayed for. But that was considered unethical and the thing, but it would have been very interesting to see what would have happened to those people. And then they looked at what happened. And so this was published in 2005. The two groups that were told you might get prayed for, but one group did get prayed for and one group didn't, they had about the same rate of complications. But the group that told they were going to be prayed for and were prayed for had higher complications. They had the other group was 52%, 51%. They were the ones that told they weren't sure whether they were going to get prayed for. The group that was sure they were going to get prayed for did worse. They were prayed for. They knew they were being prayed for, and they got worse. And everybody has scratched their heads about this because they can't really explain, because this is statistically significant. They had a significantly higher complication rate.
Placebo effect.
it was the negative placebo effect in this particular case, and it's postulated that they knew this study was going on. When they were told that they were definitely going to be prayed for, they began to think, like, why am I definitely going to be prayed for? You know, I must be sicker. I don't know if that's true, but that's kind of the explanation that they thought that, my goodness, you know, I must be in a worse group, and therefore, and they did worse. So that's sort of the negative placebo, what's called the nocebo effect. Okay. So there's no scientific evidence to support the effectiveness of intercessory prayer. But
in these studies?
There's no scientific evidence anywhere. These studies are the best that we have, and there is no, it doesn't prove, the absence of evidence doesn't prove the non-existence of the effect. But I think these are the questions that are actually more important than whether or not there's evidence, and that is, we wanted to deal with religion and spirituality as just another method of treating illness. Or is it really something different? Is prayer outside the scope of scientific inquiry? Should we really even be trying to test this? And certainly, the quotation here is, you shall not test the Lord thy God. And is that what we're doing by this? Are we violating that statement? And do we want our physician, you want to go to your physician, you want them to advise you to stop smoking, exercise, lose weight, believe in God, and go to church?
Amen.
You're preaching to the choir.
And is religion another dimension of human life which may or may not have health benefits, and does it matter? Is the value of religion goes beyond what we can measure in health? You know, health isn't everything. So. And then other important questions are, you know, what role do we want our physicians to play in our spiritual lives? And do we want them to be aware of our spiritual lives? Some patients clearly want their physicians to participate in prayer at the bedside. And some patients are offended when the chaplain comes by and offers to just a few words of support, and they may be offended, like, why is that priest here, or why is, you know, I want that. So we have to be, one thing we have to be is very sensitive to individual needs and beliefs when you're dealing with a cross section of society.
Okay, I'm going to weigh in one more time here. When you're talking about the intercessory prayer, that's one thing. But I do argue then with, you know, here, like, is prayer outside the scope of scientific inquiry? Now, prayer as used in that question is not. I would say it's beyond intercessory prayer. Prayer could be defined as a form of scientific inquiry. You know, a prayer can be defined as a way of paying attention. And so then, in my understanding of that, it is not at odds with scientific inquiry. Now, I thought the studies on intercessory prayer was very interesting. You know, I no problem there, but I think prayer is larger than that definition.
Absolutely, and don't mean to imply that it is.
Yeah.
Do you think that we should be, the scientific community, the academic community, whatever, should be investigating? Is it something that's worthy of scientific inquiry, or are we just kind of wasting time trying to apply scientific methods to something that's...
Well, I think the scientific community should read Jonathan Swift also, and you look at both sides of the egg, you know, on that. So I think, and say which side do we want to go in from, you know. But when I see his prayer outside the scope of scientific inquiry. I would say, well, my definition of prayer, my walk with prayer, includes scientific inquiry. That doesn't mean that I'm playing God on that. So that's just me. And I'm done.
Well, I didn't have an answer. I posed it as a question.
Could I ask a question about that?
Sure.
The way I see it a little bit, Jim, is that it's almost like what we were talking about this morning in Bible study about what is spirituality, what is prayer. You know, I mean, it's different for different people, and how you feel about prayer is different for different people. So how can you measure that? How can you break that down scientifically? And
Well, I think the theologians in the room, you know, here, and I am contrarian, you know, in pretty much all manners of my being, but I believe theology is an exploration of reality. You know, I don't see. So I do think this.
Are you a more all-encompassing? Is that?
No, I think I'm pretty much evidence-based. But I think the definition here is different. If we're talking intercessory prayer, you know, what you put up at the beginning is different from what we have here at the end. I think prayer is much larger in its observable practice definitions.
Okay.
One or two comments, and then you know, the bell rang. And
I wanted to, you know, I think the healing ministry of the church is broader than simply a prayer ministry. And back in the 80s in the Midwest, I don't know how it reached out here, but you know, back in the 80s there in at least in Iowa and Wisconsin, maybe in Minnesota as well, we went, and we have a parish health minister at our church. And we also went to healing services within a worship setting. Now, the year we did that, we had no deaths. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about a congregation of 2,000. Now, the next year, they were double, but I'm just saying.
Did you stop having those?
We apparently stayed off something. But you know that, to me, you know, that was a huge thing as part of our ministry at our church, was to recover some of that healing ministry of the church, which is not just the medical. It's not only in the medical, and somehow I think we've, you know, you take care of that, we'll take care of the word and sacrament, which also has a lot to say about healing, but we found that to be just a huge piece of who we became and are as a church. And our healing ministry, our healing services, to me, you know, became the most powerful services of our congregation, in which almost 80 to 90% of the people came for the laying on of hands and the anointing of oil. And you know, so I just wanted to share that. And,
question: what is healing?
Well,
when you talk about healing, what do you mean?
Well, the ancient church, you know, there is the laying on of hands, the anointing of oil, and prayer, and those three things. That's how, and there is the service of healing that you go through.
Does that mean I'm going to get well and be well?
Oh no! I mean, that's why I say healing.
That's what I'm asking.
Healing is, and it's not only about the outcomes. It has to do with the process of health. And I'm sure there were those that would have that idea, you know, that it's that, you know, the Oral Roberts kind of thing, you know, be healed. You know, and there's a, you know, and there is that peace within faith, you know, based, you know, church as well.
Well, I think we the medical profession and the spiritual profession, whatever we call it, profession, has a role to help our sick people and to help keep our communities healthy. And I think we accept that as a common challenge to achieve that. Yes.
I think too is if we look at prayer as not necessarily a cure for a health, for an illness, but as part of the care of that individual as they are experiencing the illness and either living or dying through that, that kind of gets us back to some of the conversation yesterday evening about instead of trying to keep people alive who really have, they're at the end of their lives and their health is truly failing, using prayer and other religious experiences to surround that person and help that person and companion that person into their own death can be a very positive way.
Could I just make a comment not to her last, when we were through the, I was ill and quite uncomfortably ill, and my church brought the prayer shawl, and the minister talked and prayed with me, and then when I spread that over me, I just felt such a warmth and comfort, and every time I would put it over me, I would feel like there were hands from church coming to comfort me. Mentally, I do not say to myself that prayer shawl healed me. I think the science that the doctors brought to me healed me, but it brought such comfort.
You felt better knowing that people cared and offering their thoughts and prayers to you.
And that did help heal you.
Sure, absolutely.
There's no question. Yeah. That helped heal
you. And I think it says that it can help that you can live in grace and peace. Prayer can help you live in grace and peace. And I'd hate to bargain with God, heal this person.
How about this other person? He died.
Right? I think God operates that way.
Thank you all very much.